So welcome back after the tea break. As Dharma Sri said at the beginning, our theme is transforming self and world, and particularly looking at the Sevenfold Puja in terms of transforming self. And we will be bringing in many themes from Buddhist Action Month to tie in with transforming world. So today we've reached the third stage of the Sevenfold Puja, and in reflecting on what's led up to the puja and the puja itself, actually has brought up a lot of personal reflections about how I personally have transformed through taking part in Sevenfold Pujas, many, many Sevenfold Pujas, over the years. And so I think I'm going to bring that into this talk. I'm going to start us with, just do a bit of a recap. So we started a couple of weeks ago. Vijayashri introduced us to the theme of puja and ritual and devotion. And we looked at the worship section. And I would just say what we started to look at was different moods. So there are different moods in the puja. I'd also just remind everyone that the Sevenfold Puja, which is a core ritual puja for our tradition, the Triratna tradition, is derived from a 7th century classical Indian Buddhist text called the Bodhicharavatara. So it derives from classical Buddhist texts, but it has been verses from it have been adapted by our teacher Sangharachita, and it follows, I guess traditionally, seven moods. So we started with the first mood, which was worship, a couple of weeks ago. I guess you could say in this first section, going back to it, where we're making offerings, we're opening ourselves up to enlightenment energies by inviting and welcoming what the words are, the princes of the sages in the first verses. And I have to say, in reflecting on me and how I've transformed through doing puja, I've kind of struggled with that phrase, princes of the sages, because I think, well, where is the Buddha in that? And I think what I've worked with over the years is my tendencies towards literalism, that I'm quite literal. And but I also think it helps to know the context of the puja if we're finding it a bit strange and foreign, or we struggle with the words. And I think it's helpful to know that these words, this puja, comes from this Shantideva text, which is from the Mahayana tradition, which brings in a lot of poetry and rich imagery. And to engage our emotions behind what you could call, I guess, the Buddha principle, which includes the historical Buddha, but also followers after him who gained enlightenment, and a richer way of beings, both mythical and historical, called bodhisattvas, who aspired and achieved, and are continuing to aspire and achieve, because we probably have bodhisattvas living in the world today, for the benefit of all beings. So it was helpful for me to know that that's who the princes of the sages are, and also to open up to that richness of the poetry and mythical aspect. And the aspiration to gain enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings, known as bodhicitta, is in a sense of what we aspire to and are inviting in the form of these princes of the sages at the beginning of the puja. So we're connecting through inviting in the Buddha, these bodhisattvas, these great beings. We're connecting to how they inspire us, but we're also welcoming them. And we welcome them very beautifully, with words describing beautiful flowers that we offer, weaving garlands. So there's a lot of care and skill in what we're going to offer them, scattering that at their feet, jewel-encrusted lamps. And Vijayashri also read some of the very beautiful offering verses from the actual Bodhicharavatara. So we engage our speech. So this is, we start by engaging our speech, by speaking these words, these beautiful poetic words. And then after we connect, we invite in the Buddha and the Bodhisattva and these enlightenment energies, we engage our bodies behind these words by physically making offerings, by bowing, offering candles, incense to what they represent as our human potential, and also gratitude, great gratitude for having the teachings. And then last week, I believe we moved on to the second mood. I think that was Amaraghosha who led the class, salutation. And salutation is a respectful greeting. And having invited in and imagined the Buddha and these bodhisattvas or these enlightenment energies in the forms of all sorts of beings, we pay our respects, and by doing so, we acknowledge that we are inviting in something much bigger than ourselves, something bigger than we are. We are not equals to these enlightenment beings. We are making room for something much bigger and higher than ourselves. And as one Buddhist teacher said, big mind can't come into a cramped space. That is a space filled with a lot of me and who I am, that think there's nothing higher or bigger to look up to. So we pay our respects. So we acknowledge that there is something far more attained than we are, and we pay respect to that. So far I've talked about engaging our voices, our speech, by repeating words. And we talked about engaging our whole bodies by making offerings. But what about our hearts and minds? So Buddhism is very complete in looking at the human being. So often we're looking at how do we bring the whole of ourselves into our practice, and that's what pujas are about. But I think most of us are not going to say these words or engage our bodies completely wholeheartedly at first. But over the years I have seen we do get quite devotional types that come, that completely, just completely engage with it from the very first. But for most of us Westerners, we're entering quite a strange and foreign world when we start reciting the words of the puja. By starting out with worship and making offerings and paying respect, we're working against Western cultural conditioning that encourages us to be individuals, that reveres scientifical materialism and rationalism and is very suspicious and even hostile to ritual. And particularly, I think, the idea of bowing, putting someone or something above the individual. I myself have had to work hard to be open to this kind of ritual. I think we all have our different conditionings. I was raised as a Catholic and didn't have a very positive experience of ritual, particularly around spending years as a teenager having to repeat words I didn't particularly connect to or believe in, which I found a very painful experience. So when I enter the word of a sevenfold puja, I have had to work against this conditioning and my conditioning as a Westerner. I also have to work against my personal preferences because I don't particularly like the words chosen for the puja. I like other words from the Bodhisattvatara, so I'm quite a picky word person. But over the years, I've seen working through my personal preferences as a very positive thing. I'm actually working against seeing myself as the center of the universe. And connecting with much higher ideals. And I think what's helped me do this is that it's a collective practice, that we do this collectively with people with similar ideals, with many people I highly respect, and also letting go of my preference with regards to my teacher, who I greatly revere and see as far more spiritually attained as I am, than I am, who chose these words, and also the text from Shantideva, who obviously is a very, very evolved, was a very, very evolved spiritual practitioner. And I think you could say that working against seeing ourselves as the center of the universe is a key aspect, I think, as of collectively participating in a puja, and we really need that. Deep down, we know we really need that. I mean, in lots of ways, we naturally can't help seeing ourselves as the center of the universe, and our society greatly reinforces this. We are bombarded with all the choices and preferences we could make that kind of firm up our individual lifestyle. I think of Facebook with all the likes, and we're encouraged to buy bigger and better things that kind of, you know, build up the sense of me, my nuclear family, or me as an individual that can get everything it wants. But somewhere we know that me at the center of the universe just can't be true, that it can't be real. For one thing, we're aware of how millions of others are walking around thinking the exact same thing. For example, I mean, I've always been struck being in a highly crowded situation, walking around with my friends perhaps saying, it's so crowded here. And then overhearing other people saying the exact same thing. Everyone's saying, it's so crowded. And just realizing, I'm part of that crowd for other people. And it's because we all think we're the center of the universe. It's still a stretch, I think. I guess opening up to letting go of or aspiring or practicing to let go of that sense of me and my preferences, me at the center of the universe, by entering the world of a puja that we're doing collectively, that we're doing repeatedly too. We do it repeatedly, and we do it repeatedly because I guess you could say we have plenty in the world pulling us away, that we're bombarded with. We have plenty of tendencies that we've built up that pull us away. And this repetition and the reminders just bring us back. And we do it collectively. We remind each other. I do think it's... particularly, you know, where we start with this worship, where we're evoking a very different world from our everyday life. I mean, I think of that when I walk through Croydon and then come do a puja, where this worship section evokes a very beautiful world. It evokes a very reverential world, and it evokes something very otherworldly with these princes of the sages. In a lot of ways, I can't think of a bigger contrast. We're starting with connecting with very high aspirations and ideals. The main one being gaining enlightenment for the sake of all living beings. So I, You know, and I personally sometimes, you know, I won't just sit down and feel wholeheartedly reverential. You know, I might just, but you know, over the years, I've become less, it's become more and more profound and meaningful to me, particularly over the years of building it up to doing others. Vajanya, one of our teachers, suggests that we should not worry too much about feeling wholehearted, but to see the Sevenfold Puja as a rehearsal, as a rehearsal. And I'll just read a few words that he says. He says, we are rehearsing the role of a trainee bodhisattva, that is, someone who aspires to gain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, dressing in a robe that is several sizes too big for us. There's nothing dishonest about this. When we are children, we play at different aspects of being an adult as a preparation for taking on the role of an adult. And particularly when we rehearse the last stage of the puja, where we give away all we've practiced, we're playing at being grown up in the fullest sense. But this rehearsing is quite necessary. This training is quite necessary, and there's nothing dishonest about not feeling, oof, I can immediately connect with the words, because there's something much bigger than the words that goes on behind the puja. And that's what I've learned over the years, and that's been very, very transformative. It's very much helped me let go of myself as the sense of being a center of the universe. So moving on to the next section. So we have our invitation, we have our salutation, our worship and offerings. So we then move on to the going for refuge section of the puja, which we chant every Saturday in Pali and English. And you could say that this is the heart of the puja. It's at the heart of the of our practice as Buddhists. And it's paying salutation, paying homage to the three jewels of the Buddha, the Dharma, and his spiritual community, or the Arya Sangha, which I'll go into in a bit. And besides these words in Pali, I will also say that this chanting of these words of Pali, it connects us more specifically with the historical Buddha. And also, you know, the opening verses are from very much connected with this Mahayana, very mythical tradition of Buddhism. But here we're going back to the historical Buddha, the words in Pali. It goes back to the Buddha's followers. And when, obviously, the Buddha, historical Buddha, had a huge, huge impact on people, and taught for over 60 years, came into contact with many, many, many peoples, all walks of life. And there are many, many discourses that describe people becoming incredibly moved and inspired, bursting into tears, and what they say is, I go for refuge to the Buddha, I go for refuge to his teaching, and I go for refuge to his Sangha. And that includes teachers at the time who, because there were many spiritual groups at the time who used to go and want to debate the Buddha, show him up, and show themselves to be superior teachers. And then they would be overwhelmed, and they would also go for refuge. And so we are familiar with the Pali and the English version, but from the puja, there's a prelude that we don't say at the beginning of the class, and I'll just read it out to you. This very day, I go for my refuge. to the powerful protectors whose purpose is to guard the universe, the mighty conquerors who overcome suffering everywhere. Wholeheartedly also, I take my refuge in the Dharma they have ascertained, which is the abode of security against the rounds of rebirth. Likewise, in the host of bodhisattvas, I take my refuge. So, it starts out with this very day. So there's something very, very immediate about it. And it's in this moment recollecting, refreshing, reconnecting with our commitment to follow the Buddha and his teachings. And then I go for my refuge to the powerful protectors. Again, I've had to work with words, because I can, you know, I used to be quite literal. No, I go for refuge to the Buddha. And but it's again, it's poetic. And what our teacher says, in the sense we're going to refuge to enlightenment beings and or Buddhas. What our teacher says, that the sense that the Buddhas are said to be protectors is not that they guard the universe in the way that God is supposed to protect us from worldly disasters. It is that they keep open the way to enlightenment. So there's something quite different about that. It's, in a sense, keeping open the way to enlightenment. Again, it's down to us to move towards enlightenment. They're just, you know, I guess energies that are helping something in the universe to respond to that. And then we take refuge in the Dharma they have ascertained. And it's the abode of security against the rounds of rebirth. Now, this is something I've struggled with and have reflected with, and I think a lot of Westerners struggle with the idea of rebirth, and for me the Dharma is much more meaningful than rebirth. There's something different for me personally about the Dharma, but I think also, I don't discount it, but it's not unusual. There are Western Buddhists who don't believe in rebirth. That's not what our teacher would teach. And I personally have faith in the Buddha and his enlightenment experience. So I don't strongly believe in it, but I don't disbelieve in it. And at the time, and the Buddha Buddhism came out of an Indian Eastern tradition where it's very much more part of that outlook of the East. Again, I'm just letting go of, respecting what my teacher and the Buddha taught. So I go back to that, which many, those I really respect also, practice around. And then likewise, in the host of bodhisattvas, I take my refuge. So this is a way of describing Sangha as being comprising Sangha. You know, there are many levels of Sangha. You know, we're Sangha. We're coming together, practicing around the Buddha's teaching. But there's also a higher level of Sangha, of a community of attained or enlightened beings that we also go for refuge to. Yes, and then we repeat. So we repeat the puja many times, but in this very, very crucial section, we repeat the first three lines three times. So again, there's something about I let go and trust that there's something about repetition that's going into my brain somewhere. And it connects me with, gratitude and reverence. So I do think, you know, from my Catholic upbringing, I do have resistance to repetition. And I think, you know, maybe even as Westerners we might. But again, it's, I guess, training. Something can go in subconsciously. We're reaching subconscious energies with puja. And something about having faith. I guess you bring in faith about repetition, that something else, you're opening up to something else coming in. And the first three lines, Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa, it's homage to him, the blessed one, the worthy one, the perfectly enlightened one. So I do try to really connect with my sense of gratitude and devotion there. But I think it's, I don't just wait for it to happen. I have to bring something of me into it. I have to reflect, well, how am I grateful? In what way have I experienced the great benefits of the Buddha and his teachings in my life and other people's lives? So it's sort of bringing something to it. And then Buddham saranam gacchami, Dhammam saranam gacchami, Sangham saranam gacchami. To the Buddha for refuge I go, to the Dharma for refuge I go, to the Sangha for refuge I go. We repeat that three times. So again, there's a repetition. So then dutyampi means second time, and tatyampi means third time. So there's something about threes in Buddhism. But somebody once, I can't remember who suggested seeing again this wholehearted approach, that the first time it's my body, it's with my body I go for refuge. So I imagine physical acts. And then the second one, it's speech. And the third one, mind. So I kind of imagine how I go for refuge with my body, with my speech, with my mind. But they're just, I think it's just part of our practice to find ways to connect to that. Because of a lot of Latin masses I've been to, I can switch off to foreign languages. So, you know, for me it was quite important to know what the words meant. And it's an action going for refuge. So it's something we do, something we're actively doing all our lives. And this word refuge is a very powerful word in Buddhism, and it's something very fruitful to reflect in. So what do we go for refuge to in our lives? What helps us feel we're protected or safe? Well, from the Buddha's perspective, the only true refuge and protection from suffering is the Dharma, is the truth, is the reality as taught by the Buddha in a very ancient Udana, which literally means exhale. The Buddha tells his monks that there exists an unborn, unmade, unoriginated, uncompounded reality, and that this is what makes it possible to be free of suffering, the suffering of human existence. And it essentially means it's a reality that's not subject to things being dependent, being impermanent and dependent, codependent. And essentially what we humans do, we tend to fix things as permanent in our lives, and we tend to go for refuge to that. We know somewhere that's not going to really keep us safe, or is ultimately really beneficial. But we all tend to do that, and that's just ever since, it seems, ever since mankind has existed. And there is a wonderful ancient exchange between the cattle herder Danya and the Buddha, where Danya is describing all the things he has in his life. He has cattle, he has children, he has a house, and he's becoming very smug and complacent. And he's saying, "Yeah, let it rain, let the floods come. I'm fine. You know, this is what I've built all that." And then there's an exchange with the Buddha. And I thought it would be quite fun to act this out. And I have there's also Mara comes into this. Now Mara is a symbol, I guess, of negative tendencies, of temptations, and Inga has kindly agreed to play. I have two wonderful assistants. I have Jane will play Danya, and Inga will play Mara, and I'll stand in for the Buddha, which is a big fit. But I thought it would be nice just to get another window into how we have our human tendency. You could come up. Should we come up here? Because actually, I'm going to have to share. Could you come up? Let me see. Maybe we'll stand here. If I have it. Okay. So Danya starts. So this is called. This is Danya. Danya the cattleman.
The rice is cooked, my milking done. I live with my people along the banks of the Mahi. My hut is roofed, my fire lit. So if you want rain, God, go ahead and rain.
And here's the Buddha. Free from anger, my stubbornness gone. I live for one night along the banks of the Mahi. My hut's roof is open. My fire out. So if you want rain, God, go ahead and rain.
No mosquitoes or gadflies are to be found. The cows range in the marshy meadow where the grasses flourish. They could stand the rain if it came. So if you want rain, God, go ahead and rain.
A raft well made has been lashed together. Having crossed over, gone to the far shore, I've subdued the flood. No need for a raft is to be found. So if you want rain, God, go ahead and rain.
My wife is compliant, not careless, is charming, has lived with me long. I hear no evil about her at all. So, if you want rain, God, go ahead and rain.
My mind is compliant, released, has long been nurtured, well tamed. No evil is to be found in me. So if you want rain, God, go ahead and rain.
I support myself on my earnings. My sons live in harmony, free from disease. I hear no evil about them at all. So if you want rain, God, go ahead and rain.
I'm in no one's employ. I wander the whole world on the reward of my awakening. No need for earnings is to be found. So if you want rain, God, go ahead and rain.
There are cows, young bulls, cows in calf, and breeding cows, and a great bull, the leader of the herd. So if you want rain, God, go ahead and rain.
There are no cows, no young bulls, no cows in calf or breeding cows, no great bull, the leader of the herd. So if you want rain, God, go ahead and rain.
The stakes are dug in, immovable. The new munja grass halters are well woven. Not even young bulls could break. So if you want rain, God, go ahead and rain.
Having broken my bonds like a great bull, like a great elephant, tearing a rotting vine, I never again will lie in the womb. So if you want rain, God, go ahead and rain.
The great cloud rained down straight away, filling the lowlands and high. Hearing the rain god pour down, Dania said, how great our gain that we've gazed on the Blessed One. We go to him, the one with vision, for refuge. May you be our teacher, great sage. My wife and I are compliant. Let's follow the holy life under the one well gone. Gone to the far shore of aging and death. Let's put an end to suffering and stress.
Those with children delight because of their children. Those with cattle delight because of their cows. A person's delight comes from acquisitions, since a person with no acquisitions doesn't delight.
Those with children grieve because of their children. Those with cattle grieve because of their cows. A person's grief comes from acquisitions, since a person with no acquisitions doesn't grieve. So, thought we'd have a few reflections about this refuge, how we use, I guess, acquisitions or things in our lives to, I guess, become a little smug like Dania, or perhaps a bit separated from what's most important to us, or what we really, I guess, our spiritual ideals, become a bit complacent. So maybe if you get to sit comfortably, I'll lead us in just a few reflections. So settling down into our sitting postures. And connecting with our breaths. And connecting with ourselves and how we are right now. And connecting with a sense of our overall lives the way they are right now. Is there anything in our lives that we see as permanent, perhaps because we want them to be permanent? So it could be where we live, people in our lives, acquisitions. And of course, they all can contribute to our sense of well-being, and that's very important. But is there some way that they contribute to us drawing in on ourselves, to feeling we're safe little islands? Or perhaps have a sense we're a bit out of touch with the way things really are. Are we a bit like Dania, feeling quite insulated in our worlds? Can we be inspired by the example of the Buddha, who went forth from all of that and has inspired countless generations of followers to gain liberation or more freedom and happiness, freedom from suffering in their lives? So in a sense, we're just asking ourselves this question. We don't have to come up with any particular answers. It's just a practice in itself to ask that reflective question, and perhaps something else might occur later on. But in a moment, I'll ring the gong, and we could perhaps gather in groups, small groups, maybe two or three people, and see if anything's come up from the talk or this reflection.